amazing. His last name I have had as much trouble with, as long as I know him as most people have with anonymity, Clancy Emmonsman.
My name is Clancy Emmonsland, and I'm an alcoholic. As who wouldn't be, I think. Before I say anything more stupid, I'd like to start off with something that happened to me a week and a half ago or so that you might get a kick out of. About 10 years ago, I was in school, and a boy and I had come back from the Navy after the war and gone back to school, and he was fresh out of high school, but we were in the same grade, quite an age difference, and he was one of these clean-cut all-American types that repel me on sight, and you, I'm sure. But he and I banded together and pooled our meager resources, and we won the National Intercollegiate Championship in 1949, and he and I made up the team. And even at that time, people were saying, why can't you be like Dick, good old Dick, clean-cut, all-American boy, you rotten, sodden bum? And my wife used to tell me about why couldn't I be like Dick, and my parents, and the president of the college, and my friends. And in the ensuing years, things got worse. We pulled farther and farther apart. I kept sinking deeper into the mire. And each time I'd get in jail, I'd wonder, what's for his old Dick tonight? Old Dick kept rising, and I kept sinking. Eventually, I was committed to the nut house, and Dick was elected president of the Junior Chamber of Commerce. By this time, I'd left Wisconsin far behind me. I wanted to be as far away from this wretch as I could be. And I got thrown into jail in new and different states and cities under new and varying conditions. And Dick, with perseverance and pluck, rose to the top. Last year, I think we achieved our widest division. I'm sure everyone that I knew said, why can't, well, we know, why can't Clancy be like that person? So last year I finally wound up in a new area in the Phoenix drunk tank, and I was done driving, giving me the boots because I'd vomited on his bed. And old Dick was elected president of the state Junior Chamber of Commerce, and made the executive of the bank in my hometown. That a typical success story that just makes your heart warm for America. So about 2 weeks ago, I got a letter from my mother and had a clipping on it. And I pulled it out and I opened the front page of my hometown paper. And whose picture was on the front page? And the headline was, Dusterbeck arrested in Los Angeles. Dusterbeck had embezzled from his bank. And so, Dusterbeck, I went down to see him when I found out. He'd run away to Los Angeles. Neither one of us knew we were here. I was out here. He was living down in Colorado someplace. And he was extradited back to Wisconsin and has been sentenced to do 1 to 5 in the state prison at Waupun now. And here I am, clean cut, sober, and alert. Justice anywhere in this world, someone will write to him and say, Dick, why can't you be like that? I got quite a laugh out of that clipping, though. I showed it to everyone that could stand still long enough to look at it. It did give me a laugh, but it did call back that perhaps my past years could have been a little better spent than they were. Late last summer, early last fall, I guess, I spoke here. I think it's the first talk I ever gave in Los Angeles of any length. And I remember coming in and thinking, well, I don't have much to say. I haven't been sober very long, but I can tell them what happened to me. It was pretty flamboyant, the areas I operated in my drinking. I remember when I got done how good I felt that I'd gotten so much of that confessional phase out of shorter period of time than some others. It happened maybe in a 12-year period in which I achieved various heights and various depths that I wouldn't care to go through again. There was, I can think with joy of the days that I was a brilliant young newspaper reporter with a great future. And then they decided I wasn't very brilliant anymore, and so I no longer was. And I tried to become a brilliant young advertising man. I was successful for a while. I was a brilliant young engraving production manager. And I was a brilliant young dishwasher. I was a brilliant young janitor. And I was a brilliant young piano player on Skid Row. And I was a brilliant young many, many occupations. And now I not only am no longer brilliant, but I fear I'm no longer young. But the pains for me, I am sure, are no different in effect than the pains were for each of you. I think we're all here because the pain became intolerable and we reached a certain limit which we could no longer cope with. We had to do something. The anesthetic was no longer doing the job, the anesthetic we counted on. As I stand here and I was joking about Dick, and I mentioned the Nut House, and I remember that very clearly. 2 years and a half ago, I was committed to the Texas State Hospital for the insane for the rest of my life because I was hopeless. I had been through every private means known to sober me up or to get me to act decently. Well, nothing could do it. And I thought at that time, if there ever was a bottom, this must be the bottom. But it wasn't the bottom, because I still felt that Clancy could control his own life. He's learning from these experiences, and he can learn to control it. I remember with a great deal of pain the day that I was babysitting for my daughter and son at that time, and I went down to get a beer and got back 3 days later, and my son had died from pneumonia in my absence because the furnace had gone out in the cold Wisconsin day, and Daddy was drunk, and no one knew about it. And I thought, this must be the bottom for anyone, I thought at that time. And it was. But I thought, well, it was an accident. I can drink. It wasn't the beginning. It was something else. And I think of the time that, in a more humorous vein, that I lay on the second floor of a hospital with tubes in my arms and up my nose and being pumped out, as we all have been, one turn or another, one way or another. And on the fourth floor, my wife was also in the hospital giving birth to a baby. And I remember how badly I felt that the nurses would come to the door and scowl at me and talk to one another and point upstairs, and then at me, and I used to lie there and ride and cringe and think how bad these girls are. They should be sympathizing with me, and so they're sympathizing with my wife. Anybody has children, but I'm sick. And I thought there should be a bottom, but it wasn't a bottom. There were no bottoms, because I am cursed, as many people are, I suppose, in varying degrees, with a complete self-indulgence. As long as there's anybody to listen to me, and as long as there's anybody I can work on, whose sympathy I can utilize for my own ends, as long as I can go a little farther, I will go. I remember the time that on a drunk I killed my best friend. I thought, this was the bottom. What can I do? I thought maybe I could stop drinking. No, that didn't come to me. I thought, I have to run away, as I have done so many times in my life. I ran away from the Midwest. I played the piano on Skid Row in San Francisco for 4 months until a friend found me and pulled me off. These things are not important in themselves, except that what is my bottom evidently is maybe worse than someone else's bottom and better than another person's bottom. Bottoms are strictly relative. It's how much I could force on myself, how stupid I was, how self-willed I was before something got through to me. And I don't know where the difference comes. I wish there was a line or a marker or a flag that would go up and say, you've now had enough, you're never going to drink again, this is it. But you don't know. This afternoon at the 6200 Club, I was sitting here after the meeting, a fellow came up and he said, Clancy, he said, I hate to confess this to you, he said, but I'm just coming off a drunk. And I'd seen him several times. He said, I've been to 90 straight meetings. 90 70 meetings in 90 days, every night. He said, and I was feeling so good, I felt that I couldn't be an alcoholic. So he's been drunk a week and he lost his job and he's starting over again. But for him, he had to find out again. I hope he doesn't have to find out anymore. I hope I don't have to find out anymore. Whatever my difficulties are, I've almost to the conclusion that drinking again will not help him. As the book says, and as the grapevine says this month, and as everybody says, no one ever came off a drink richer or healthier or in possession of more material benefits than they started. You may wind up with some things. I came back and wound up with a big lump on my noggin here, you can still see, when I challenged the city of Juarez one evening to a... And it only took one, and it didn't take him very long. My pride, anyway. Then you wind up with some new charges being placed against you, or you wind up with a new sense of remorse. You've added to the remorse that already was intolerable, and here you've added to it. So there's nothing you can do now except drink some more to forget it. So eventually, I think we all get to the point where the pain gets so intense, at least it did for me, that I could do nothing. And very strong graphic things, as I say, happened to me because I must have gone on my way to make them happen. Everything had to be good because they were perfectionist. I guess I wanted to be the biggest bum. But interspersed in between, I would have these moments. I'm still good. I can't seem to handle my liquor sometimes, but I am good. And I've been on a sustained rally, which I'm sure much of it has done. When I came out of the nut house, I finally got sprung because I had brought culture to the state of Texas. I started a newspaper in the nut house. And early in my career there, I had broken out. And being Texas is what it is, it's rather flat. And once you break out, they can see you running for about 4 days in any direction. So it's no problem to get you back, but it was quite a feat to break out. So they brought me back, and they gave me a special treatment to reserve for people like me. They massaged my head with electrodes. Shock treatments, they put me on the 2 a day, which is the maximum for wild people, and they slowed me down considerably. I very well remember the day I woke up after coming off the shock therapy. They had me on, 24 jolts or something. 2 a day for 6 days, and then 3 a week for 4 weeks or something like that. I don't know, but anyway, what happens to you, you lose your senses, you're gone, you have no conception of who you are, where you've been, or what happened to you, or what, why you're there. And then you start to come out of it eventually after one of these seizures. I woke up and I looked around, and I remember I was playing piano in San Francisco 2 years ago. I looked around and there were bars on the windows, and I didn't know at the time, but I was in the violent end of the locked ward in a little room, and everybody in here was about in the same shape. I thought, my goodness, who are these strange-looking people, you know? Who are these folks? What am I here to... And I couldn't make out who I was, didn't quite know my name exactly, or why I was there, certainly, because all the 2 years had been wiped out of my memory. And I thought for a while that I'd died and gone to hell. And I really did. I thought I was in hell briefly, until someone cursed me. One of the attendants cursed me, and then I knew that they didn't even talk like that in hell, I suppose. But I became a very model patient. I didn't know why I was there for a long time, but I knew I didn't want to stay there. So I did everything they said, and I started a newspaper, and I directed a Christmas cantata of patients. That was a circus. Opinion 4 months after I got out until I got to my birthday, my first birthday. I found all the time, I'm shocked he missed it, because that's only fair, I hadn't drank. So the day of my first birthday, I thought to myself, well, I've given it a chance. Doesn't make it, I'm not happy. My wife is still mean, my children are loud, my boss is cantankerous. A sensitive flower like me needs a little stimulation. So I stopped into Juarez and had a little vodka on the way to get my birthday cake. And it was relatively restless, as Mr. Smirnoff says. And so I never got to get my cake. I used to still sitting there waiting. I mean, I'm old and tired by now. This was a couple of years ago. But I learned a lesson. I learned how to drink sociably. I drank a few drinks and I went home. And the next night I drank a few drinks and I went home. And this continued for weeks. I was so afraid of shock treatment that something must have stopped me. And I was about ready to write my article for Drink How I Returned to Social Drinking, the first in history. And I got a very excellent job in Dallas. I went over there and worked on such great projects as the conversations between Elsie and Elmer, the Borden cows, and Hager Slacks, and what kind of slacks that people are wearing, and Fritos, the commercials for Fritos that you see on television that make you so thirsty that you get drunk and then the Fritos bring you out of it. Evidently, what you worked on, I believe. And I socially drank, and I went to all the advertising parties, and I drank martinis, and every once in a while I came to work, and I was there at Christmas time, and got a lot of bottles, and it was fine. I brought my wife, and she came to Dallas, and had another daughter. I had 4 daughters now, and I was expansive and wealthy and nice home and a car. But, of course, it's inevitable. My drinking was catching up, and pretty soon, bang, I was in the sanitarium. I got a good job, took me back, bang, I was fired. Then I went to work at another job, equally good, because they thought, I still had places to go and con people. I said, now, give me one more chance, because I've seen my mistake, all right? I think what's wrong is I've been drinking too many martinis. I'll just drink beer and I'll drink it at home. And I had a job as a manager of a very large plant in the graphic arts field. And I did a very fine job, and I went back from the sanitarium for a week this time. And finally, my wife and children left me for the final time. And I lost my job, and everything came to an end. Every chance I'd had finally ended. And I thought, boy, I'm really being persecuted. This is too much. So I rented a car. My car was gone. My house was gone. My family was gone. And I rented a car, whipped off through Wichita Falls, and wrote a newspaper for some clinical campaign. I just had a typewriter in a hotel room and drank and wrote a whole newspaper. Whipped off. Drove across the state, careened that hotel all the way across Texas in this rented car to El Paso. Got drunk, got thrown into the bullfight, which is a very hard thing to do in Juarez. Alienated every friend I had in El Paso. And careened off to see what's happening farther north in Oklahoma. And as I finally wound up in the Phoenix tank, alone, sick, broke, rotten, filthy. And since I couldn't drink, I had to face the reality that I was there and there was no place for me to go. I had just enough for within a dollar or so of paying my fine, so I got up. I remember very clearly standing in that hot summer's day in downtown Phoenix, sick, as I say, in rotten, unshaven, no place to go, and thought, what do in the world do I do now? Who can I contact that will help me out of this mess? And I had a dime. I didn't have enough to place any prepaid calls, but I called collect. I called to all my relatives in Wisconsin and in Minnesota, and I called all the places I'd worked for the last 8 years or 9 years. I called the college I'd attended. I called everyone in short that I could possibly think of that I knew. Incidentally, I called Dick and he... But not a person of all that crowd would even accept a phone call from me. They wouldn't even have to collect a phone call. And I had no conception where my wife was, and she instituting divorce. So there was nothing, I had no place to go. I had my choice right then, and this is true. We laugh at it now, but this is how we feel, at least how I felt at the time. I thought, now how can I commit suicide? not allotted to you at that time, because for we people, I think, to commit suicide, we have to envision ourselves lying in the casket, and there are all many people passing by and saying, gee, I'm sorry I was so mean to old Clancy. Otherwise, suicide is pointless. And, there wasn't anybody that would do that, I didn't think. So I thought, I can't kill myself, right? I'm denied such small privileges as this. So I walked 12 or 14 blocks through Phoenix, dodging police, and terribly alone, and walked to the Arab Club in Phoenix, and I walked in, and I sat there for 3 days and shook, and shook, and shook. I was very sick. And I finally got through to an editor that I once knew in Texas, on the guise of being a Phoenix correspondent calling in, so he accepted the charge. And I laid my story on him, and he wired me $20 on the basis that I would not use it to come back to Texas. So therefore, Los Angeles held forth its arms to me. So I came here, and I went back to AA, and I thought, I have to give AA one more chance. It's funny now, and it's funny in retrospect, these things, but we all have been there in various ways ourselves. We know the terrible feeling of, this is the end, and I think this was the end. I had much more important things that happened to me, but nothing that left me so such a feeling of alone. There's nobody now except you that gives a damn whether you live or die. So if you don't care, you're done. And I thought, what is it? I knew the book. I think one of the greatest drawbacks of that a slipper has in coming back, or a person who's played around with the program for a length of time, is that you know all the phrases. You know the book. I read the book twice, and I didn't pay any attention to it. I read the book, I knew the steps, I could recite them. I came back to AA, I knew all the cliches, I knew all the trite phrases, I ridiculed all the spiritual bourgeois that people had been pushing out. And all of a sudden I found myself in a position where I have to go back and start all over again and listen to the same things and try to believe them. Things that I spent years ridiculing. I knew them, but they didn't apply to me. Now I have to believe that they apply to me. And for any slipper, any person coming back, I think that problem is there. There's no longer any golden, wonderful honeymoon period, at least not like I've heard it described. There's no longer any magic in coming into an AA meeting. There's not going to be a mantle of fire descending on you that's going to relieve all your pains forever and ever again, as long as you live. You're going in there, you know, because this is the only damn place you can go to keep sober. And if you can't get it here, you're done. Because you've tried everything else. And so I threw myself into it. And I didn't do a very good job. I was pretty sick mentally. I know that alcohol is our problem, but I'm sure that our squirreled up thinking compounds it grievously. And one of my fears had always been that I was going insane, and I thought I couldn't stay sober and remain sane because I had so many remorses, so many things that I'd done in my life, so many opportunities I'd lost, so many people I'd alienated and hurt. And I thought, how can I possibly stay sober? This pain is so intense, I have to anesthetize it. And it wasn't very easy at first. It wasn't easy, I'm sure, for any of us at first. And I'm just saying this to confirm our own opinion. I'm like everybody else. It wasn't easy for me. And I was terribly sick, and I went to meetings. Every meeting I could find in the book. I went at night, I went in the daytime, I went at night. And I didn't have any money. I had weeks of just, the first 4 months I was in Los Angeles, my clothes were locked up more than I had them. I mean, landlords were locking them up more than I was using them. So they still retained some semblance of use because I didn't use them much when I first came here. But I didn't much care really because my thought was, I have to get sober. What can I learn in this Alcoholics Anonymous program? I thought of one thing, if there's anything I must learn something about this God nonsense. I had God pounded into me when I was a little boy. I raised in a Lutheran family where God sat in the cloud. And it seemed to me as a little boy, he sat up there somewhere and he was a mean, scowling old thing. He waited for people to make mistakes. And as soon as they made a mistake, look around and and people like that. I wouldn't pay for the guy. Why would you go to Congress? The phrase goes. And so I had to find something that I could understand. And I thought higher power, and I talked to many friends, and they helped me a great deal in formulating an opinion. And this is very brief, and I won't bore you with it, but my God, to me, my higher power is certainly not your higher power. I'm sure you all have yours. I have mine. But this was how I found mine. I think this is the one significant thing I found in AA that has helped me more than any other single thing, with this concept of a God. And I thought, now how can I approach a God? I have no use for any God I've ever heard about. But where is God? And I've begun this higher power business. I thought, well, what do I respect? What is the single factor in the world that I respect? I don't respect money. I know people's money that I hate. I don't respect physical things. I respect, I guess, intelligence. I have a great deal of respect for people that I have an infinite amount of intelligence that can think. In a small degree, I have the respect for the man who can lift the hood of my car, and I say, gee, that's a big hunk of iron, and he says, no, that's your car. There goes the carburetor. There must be something that I can evolve for me that I can believe more, that will fit what I can understand. I don't understand very well. And eventually, through months of grasping and probing, it may change tomorrow, but I came up with something that's helped me a great deal recently. And the thought, for me, my personal God, that I pray to is like, I think of as this intelligence as something maybe like a television antenna, and it's sending out a picture of good, or a picture of what is right, of serenity, peace, understanding, what you may call it, to everybody. No more to me than to you, or no more to you than to me. But we're all getting it. And I feel if I'm not utilizing it, if I'm not getting any serenity or peace, I've been mucking around with these dials on my set, and there's something wrong with the receiver. There's nothing wrong with the antenna sending it out. And so if I'm not careful, I get nothing. And if I work very hard, and I keep doing the things that I'm told to do, then I can understand. Then I'm in effect working a little bit with the dials, and maybe all this snow and fuzz will slow down after a while, and there'll be a little line, or there'll be a vague outline, or a vague picture, as we all have done in our TV sets. You keep playing around and hoping, this is the knob. No, this is the knob. This is the knob. And so in every way, I have to try to monkey with these sets myself. I have to try to become less intolerant. I must become less resentful. I must work on the resentful knob. I must work on all the knobs of my personal feelings that have made this picture completely undecipherable to me. And I think that if I am doing this, if I'm working, I will get some serenity. If I do not, I can't say God is persecuting me, God is making it tough on me, God has forgotten me, he's not answering my prayers. What kind of God to change gods again? This one isn't getting my messages. But I do think Clancy is sure screwing up again. Clancy better be on a stick, because Clancy couldn't sleep last night. Clancy's doing something wrong. And this way I've been able to understand it. As I say, this means nothing. I'm sure that your concept of God is much better than mine. But to me, I've been able to live with this, and I've been able to understand the 12 steps of this program in light of that. As a God who does love me, but he doesn't love me better than anybody else, and he doesn't love me less than everybody else. He loves me, and he loves you, and he loves them, and if we wish to return this love, we'll be serene, or more serene and more happy. If we do not, then we're just mucking with the dials and playing with the rabbit ears, and pretty soon it's all going to be all snow up there again, and we're going to be drunk. And I had a little trouble with humility. I feel that, I don't know about you folks, but to me, the one reason I could never achieve any humility was because I always felt so insecure and inadequate that I had to keep the front up constantly. I could never let down the front and even pretend to be humble, because people might see how really humble I really was, what a rotten bum I was. Always arrogant, smart. Always a smart remark, clever, ha ha ha, nothing ever gets through to me. Because if you keep the wall up thick enough, they'll never find out what a softy you are. Nobody can ever hurt you. You're never happy, but nobody can ever hurt you. And you go through life and you think, oh, I've got it made. Because times when you wake up in the middle of the night and you think you're going insane, and at the times you can't eat and you have to stay drunk to maintain the front, but outside of that, it's a marvelous defense against the world. And I think in AA, one of the great concepts for me, but the idea that everybody here feels as inadequate as I do. Everyone here, in one way or another, feels that they're false. They have committed the sins that I've committed. Not the same ones, but they feel they're as black as the ones I've committed. And everyone here is here for one reason. We're not here for Christ's sake, to go to the Elks Club, to sell merchandise to the guy sitting next to us. We're here for one reason, to get our sanity back. And certainly everyone must be at the end, because nobody comes in here after two beers and they don't like the beer, so they come to AA. Really, because we spend a life, or as much as we care to spend, of trying every method of cheating and robbing and lying and using every method known to stay away from facing reality. And so, but still, humility to me was a tremendous hurdle. I don't understand humility. I'm sorry, but all my life has conditioned me. For many months, I thought humility was the little humble tugging on their forelock type that smiled everything and never answered back and never did anything. And I've gone kicks like that 4 or 5 days of adopting humility. And at the end of about 5 days, I'd be so upset I'd curse everyone. All my humility came I varied constantly between this arrogance of insecurity and this trying to be humble, which didn't fool anybody, myself. And I thought, I'll never get this humility nonsense. I'm too stupid. I can't make it. And then, this may not be for anyone else, but for me, it suddenly came to me that maybe humility, for me, I could think of as teachability. Because part of my front was all the time, you can't tell me anything, I know it, and I know it first, and I know it better. And the idea that maybe somebody else could teach me something, maybe I could listen to someone else, maybe I could sit night after night after night in an AA meeting, not just to come in out of the cold, but to listen and try to apply what I'm hearing, try to apply to my own life and my problems. And somehow or other, by using teachability for humility, I found a little piece that probably is not the correct way to work AA, and I wouldn't suggest it to anyone else, certainly. But for me, this is what I found these past months, that I can maybe a little bit be taught. Maybe I can be taught more next week, and maybe I hope much more next year. But at least I've been able to listen a little bit. I've been able to get enough security so I can take down the front enough so I can let people know that I'm listening. And that is to me, a marvelous thing, because the pressure's off. You don't have to impress so many people anymore. You don't have to keep conning. You can kind of sit back and say, well, if you don't like me, you don't know what you're missing, because I'm all right. It's a marvelous feeling. But I've had some good things in AA. I mean, no material things. Especially, during the time I've been here, I've been one of the outstanding janitors on South La Brea. We're perfectionists, and I have tried to get the cleanest windows in our shopping center. I have washed dishes up on the Sunset Strip, and I'll never sneer at another dishwasher again, because I couldn't even cut it. These guys were waiting for me, and I was slow, and I thought, this is pretty sad. I spent all my life making fun of dishwashers, and I can't even do it. But it was a good experience, because I was doing something on my own I wasn't conning anybody, I wasn't cheating anybody, I was working my fingers to the bone for a 12 and 13 hour shift at night. I felt good in the morning. I felt awfully tired and I felt cross, but I felt, well, at least I made these bucks honestly. I didn't con anybody out of them. And I have done various things. Now next week, if things go well, or maybe not, if things go well, I'll be writing again, maybe for NBC television. If things don't work out that way, and I hope that they're going to work out, I may be back washing dishes on Sunset. But it really doesn't make any difference, because I can sleep at night, and there's the difference. That's what sobriety brings. Sobriety doesn't guarantee me, as you've heard, any jobs or anything. It gives me an ability to cope with the problems I've got within me. I'm sober enough now, if I can cope with the problems, I can go to as far as I can get these knobs going. And if I can't cope with the problems, then at least I'll be clean and I'll be off the streets and I won't be bothering people. But sobriety that is given to me is what only a chance to utilize what I've got. If I haven't got anything, I can't utilize it, but at least I'm sober. So AA, to me, has given me one other thing that I thought I'd lost. I guess the last time I cried was about when I was 9 years old. My dad beat the hell out of me for something, and I cried and grieved, and I thought, nobody will ever make me cry. And I didn't. I had tears in my eyes sometimes, but I didn't cry, because by God, nobody ever see that I was soft again. I would keep that arm so tight they'd never seen me soft. This last Christmas Eve, I was feeling a little sorry for myself. I was about 7 o'clock at night, and everyone else was going home and wrapping presents and living up, and I was sweeping out the store down there. The janitor was finishing up, and I thought, gracious, this is kind of a futile, what's the sense of keeping sober? Everybody else has got something. I got this broom for my Christmas Eve present I don't like it. And the phone rang, and my four daughters called me up, and they were on the telephone from Dallas. And each of them spoke to me in turn. They said, Daddy, we're just going to bed now, and we called you to tell you that we love you very much, and we're glad that you're getting better. And we have to go now, and we talked a minute more, and they hung up. And as I say, I probably won't see them for a long time, but I went into the washroom there, and I didn't let anybody know about it, but I locked the door, and I sat down, and I cried and cried and cried. And I think that was the nicest Christmas Eve I've ever spent in my life. I felt much closer to my children than I did last year when I was in the room with them, because last year I was drunk. And each year before that, there's always some next Christmas going to be better. But this Christmas I was closer, although separated by thousands of miles. I thought, if AA gives me nothing else, this has given me something. That my daughters like me and call me. And that they're also have inherited something from me. They call collect. So I know that I've transmitted several things to my daughters, the passion and the ability to call collect. But that was a wonderful Christmas, and from a sad Christmas Eve, I just spent all day Christmas smiling among my AA friends, spreading sunshine. This was the nicest Christmas. And that, I write to my daughter each week now, and she writes back, and we have my oldest daughter, she's about 10. She writes very well, and she's smarter than I am already, and she condescendingly passes along bits of information that I utilize. And I write with my questions, and she sends me answers. She's kind of my Dallas Norman Vincent Peale. But we get along well, and they tell me about their trials and tribulations, and I feel this is, for the first time in my life, I'm a father. And I don't see them, I don't talk to them or anything, and as I say, I probably wasn't until we grow up. I keep saying that so I can get used to the idea. But I feel that for the first time in their lives, I'm their father. Whether I'm married to their mother or not anymore, I am their father, and I love the idea very much. And sitting there listening to Mary tonight and her marvelous talk and most sincere talk, and I was thinking of all the things that I've read and felt on AA and the various things that I've tried to teach myself. I've done a very poor job in coming back compared to what I'd like to, but at least I'm not drunk tonight. I'm feeling a little bit better. And I noticed this book up there, 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. I asked Marilyn to bring it over to me, because there's something I read in here a few months ago that really jumped out and grabbed me, every line of it. And if I could think of one prayer that I could say to God as I understand Him, that could help me to convince myself what I must look for if I'm going to find sobriety. I remember reading here, and it really is very fine. It's very short. Maybe you read it, but it's wonderful. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there is hatred, I may bring love, that where there is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness, that where there is discord, I may bring harmony, that where there is error, I may bring truth, that where there is doubt, I may bring faith, that where there is despair, I may bring hope, that where there are shadows, I may bring light, that where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand rather than to be understood, to love rather than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds. It is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. Thank you.
Think not.
It's about a week or two ago. And the phone rang. He said, "Hello, what's your drop? This is Francis from way out in California." And boy, I'm telling you, no one else would have done that but Francis.
My name is Francis Gillisworth, and I'm an alcoholic.
And as I'd like to say, I'm very, very glad to be here today, safe and sane and sober. I want to thank Watt for those brief introductory remarks. When I get to be a main speaker caliber, they're going to make me a leader. A dear man and a good Alcoholics Anonymous member. I very much enjoyed. I identified and disidentified with both these excellent speakers. I identified a great deal with the problems of Sheila, Loretta, Josephine. And I disidentify. I don't see how you can get it down to two or three personalities like that. I never needed group therapy. I used to just lock myself in the closet. And I identified a great deal with Harry's intellectual attainments. Mine were not as widely recognized. There was more envy in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. But I didn't. There's one thing he said that just hit me like a rock. There's a whole difference between a Clancy and a Harry, who's a nice guy. Said he's the type of kid who'd run errands and not take coins. I took the coins and screw the errands. Put it over right under my face. On the memory lane yesterday. At 8 o'clock in the morning, the first leader that stood at this podium was a guy that spoke at my first AA meeting in 1949 in hometown of Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And they had brought me from the Eau Claire County Jail where I'd been through a series of misunderstandings. I was a young guy and sharp and brilliant, but as a cop fighter. In Eau Claire, Wisconsin, they don't much go for that. Hardly any place to go except after 12, except for the Dr. Bus Depot and stand around and look at dirty books. If you can't make it there, you can go to jail, that's all. But he's a very interesting guy, and I love him very much. In fact, a policeman just before the meeting came up and handed me a note. And this is serious, I can't find the note. But he had me a note for him saying he's in an ex-delegate meeting and he's sorry he can't be here this morning. And so I'm cutting you off, Homer, wherever you are. And last night, the last speaker of the evening was the guy who is currently my sponsor, some 21 years later, and some difficult times. And I was talking on the phone a couple of weeks ago to another sponsor I had in a different city who said, "I can't hardly believe that you're still alive, but if you're really going to speak of Miami, I have to call up to thank him for helping me to get to this point." He says, "Send me a tape at your expense." Well, that's fair enough. I'll give him a stiff check here. I'm glad to be here because I've heard in the last two or three days many wonderful talks from wonderful people who have found this program and marched into life. And I, in a sense, in kind of a cull, I represent another facet of those who come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I am a loser, a bad loser, a sick, hostile loser, as I would like to say. Well, I live on the beach in California. We get a lot of rebellion these days. I'm sure you get some of it here, but not like there. It's really rebellion. A lot of kids out there shaking their fists at the steamroller saying, "I defy you." know, I'm no romantic till the steamroller gets to him and leaves him, you know, just a flat laying there. And I understand what they're saying, except for one thing. I feel kind of sorry for these dumb kids. They think they're the first ones that ever rebelled. They think they're the first ones that ever did that. I've been doing that as long as I've been alive. I've been fighting and kicking and screaming, and it sure is a pain in the butt after a long time, I'll tell you. I came to AA when I was quite a young man, the youngest man in AA in the state of Wisconsin at that time, and I lasted a couple months, and I realized I wasn't really an alcoholic, because these old fools, their problem was booze. Booze was just a vehicle that gave me expression. If I had problems, they were to be hidden, not to blame on booze. And I went to the next city I ran to, I went to AA and I had a sponsor, and I just about I blew myself out of that tub in a couple of years. I ran away to the next city and I got a sponsor and I blew myself out of that tub in a couple of years. I ran away to the next city and I blew myself out of that tub in a couple of years. Ran away to the next city. The next move was significant. For a downhill pull, I left San Francisco for El Paso, which is going to be some kind of an indication. And I thought I was tolerant. I thought I'd have to go seek lower companions where I can make it. When I got to El Paso, they put me in the Texas State Insane Asylum. One of our distinguished graduates sitting right down here in front. An ex-Miss Ruby Hatch. When I got out of there and I ran into another town, and I got blown out of that tub, and on and on and on. And 9 years after my first meeting, I was thinking to myself, whatever happened to me? I had the college education that I had just before I made my first move out of Eau Claire. I come from a nice family of religious people. Everything's wrong for me, except there's something wrong inside of me. There must be. Why am I standing outside the blood bank here on Skid Row without any front teeth and a torn t-shirt waiting to sell a pint of blood for $4, knowing that, like Sheila, my four daughters are gone forever. They went along the way. My father hadn't talked to me for many years. My mother, when she knew who I was, would send me a Bible verse from time to time, which provided mild consolation, such as it. I couldn't think of a single person in the world, and I've been in a lot of cities and I knew a lot of people, that I could call or write or contact and have a reasonable chance of thinking they would answer me or care what happened to me. And by this time, I was notorious in AA. I was one of the few people in Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles. I was banned from the AA club. Sober. Now, when these things happen, you start to get the feeling there may be something more than a drinking problem involved. And 9 years later, I knew, as well as I had known in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, that I was not truly an alcoholic. And I knew perfectly for one reason. Because alcoholics are people whose problem is alcohol. My problem is not really alcohol. It looks like a problem, and it is a problem sometimes, and it smells like a problem, and I can pass in any AA group anywhere as an alcoholic. But I secretly know I'm not an alcoholic because alcohol is more importantly an answer to me. It makes things soften up a little bit because there's something wrong with me. I have never had any objections when I wasn't an alcoholic at that time. And they said, is there any alcoholics here? Because I secretly do, I was putting them on, those dummies, you know. If anybody was here, is anybody here that secretly feel insane? There's one more pair of hearing soon. And that's why it's kind of funny that the last guy I hustled, he told me he couldn't help me because his sponsor told him to stay away from me. He dropped me off in front of the AA club one morning at 6 o'clock. An AA club that didn't open for 5 hours, and when it did, I was banned. And I couldn't get out of Los Angeles. You've got to get a score to get to the city limits. Most towns, you get a score and you leave town. Los Angeles, you need two scores. One to get to the city limits and another score to wherever you're going. And I couldn't put two scores together. I was a hostile, nasty, rotten, front toothless, 115-pound piece of like kind of amazing to me. That was on Halloween morning in 1958. Kind of amazing when I opened the door open, I lied to the guy and let me in, and I never had another dream. Last night, Chuck said something interesting, and he said it quite often. He said, I never had a sponsor, and I've sober. I heard him say that many times, and that's certainly true. I hear many people sometimes say, I don't have a sponsor, or I don't get so involved, and I stay sober. And yet there are other people who seem to get so involved, and they barely hang on. And I've thought about that over the years. And I think I want to discuss something with you this morning, if I may, briefly. I don't talk about it too much in talks, but I wanted this morning, so there might be somebody here who feels a little bit different. He might feel a little bit unique and doesn't really fit into 11,000 people like all of them do. You've been smart enough setting a coffee line to get that 10,000 mile stare at home. Take me to my room. Why don't you just work the program? Over my experience the past few years, I've come to a conclusion that satisfies me. There seems to be two major schools of alcoholism that I'm acquainted with. And I mean this very seriously. One group seems to be people who grow up, who make some basic social adjustment to life, then they begin to drink heavily, and eventually they drink themselves into alcoholism, and they become indistinguishable from all other alcoholics. There's another group, and I don't know how large it is, but I know a lot of them myself, who grow up and never make that first basic adjustment to living, and then they become alcoholics, and they're indistinguishable from all the other alcoholics, except for one thing. They have nothing to return to called normal living. They have no idea what... I wouldn't know normal living if one bit me in the leg. The only normal living I know is perfection. I've never had it, but I always think of that as to be happy all the time. Have wonderful family. Hold a job and don't have bad thoughts when you drive by girls in t-shirts. As Harry said, when people run over your foot, I hope I didn't hit your tire, sir. And that's what I mean when I watch it. I'm a 50-yard dash man all my life, because I can do that for about 50 yards. I can be the, every time I'm full of remorse, I can be the best man you ever saw. The way they shot it, I'm going to be a better husband and father. We're going to have a new life, and a new town, and we reunite and have a week of happiness, and the ensuing daughter comes along. It's going to be wrong. Every one of my four daughters have been born as a result of a reconciliation. One day, if you're like me, one day you know and I know, as you've done your 50 yards, and the walls start to go. And the wind says, Clancy, this is a crappy town. But being a good fellow, I was trying to stay around to the termination of pregnancy at least. We never had any runaways in our family. None of our children ever ran away from home, I'm very pleased to say. I wish I could say that about Daddy. Daddy left often and far. My cosmopolitan family, one daughter was born after got in the nut house. I saw her about five, just about shocked me out of my wits, because I said, hiya, Susie. Hiya, Daddy, Indy. She was a Texan. Scared me because in Texas, the Texas accent to me connotes shock treatments. Every time I hear somebody say, now you just relax, boy, we're gonna hit you. Whatever my problems are, I'm not truly an alcoholic. I have something grievously wrong. The best description I ever heard of that in my life, I think, is I heard a
said, all my life, I kind of had the feeling that when I was coming off the assembly line, I got right to the last operation. And somebody said, hey, God, yada, yada. And somehow I got fired after the last screw was being tightened right. Most of the time, but when the pressure's on, you're tired, sleep. And I've gone to some excellent psychiatrists. I've tried every therapy I know, because intermittently in my 50-yard dashes, I was a good writer, and I worked in good advertising agencies, and I wrote beautiful things between disintegrations. Got a little hard after I lost my front teeth, because, you know, things went up to five, you can't say. That's what I tried. I didn't make it in California that way. I made it as a dishwasher and a furniture mover. For 3 days in each job. And, pick and shovel man, there's a man sitting right down here who I used to envy till I was sick. Because we lived in the same 12-step house for 2 weeks. Midway through my first year. And he had a job downtown as a clerk. And he got on with a sack of lunch every morning in a white shirt. And I thought that was rotten. And the guy would be along with his truck today. We're going to go out and dig some clay now. Here's your pick. And another sensitive world. And I lost that job and moved back to my abandoned car. Don't touch that brake. When I was down in Shreveport, I got enough on Watt to put him in state prison for a long time. Since Chuck is now my sponsor, I try to emulate him in every way I can, so there's going to be a long meeting. But I don't want to get involved in the details in this short amount of time. I want to say something. I have tried Alcoholics Anonymous in conjunction with psychotherapy. When I had money and spent a lot of money on it. I tried Alcoholics Anonymous in conjunction with medication, some to pull me up out of suicidal depressions, and I wound up as a terrible suicidal. That's why I was put in an insane asylum in Pittsburgh, because I had committed suicide. I was committed as an alcoholic. I was committed as a schizoid, suicidal, depressive, with no prognosis of recovery. There was no alcoholism on my rap sheet at all, just... I had to simulate alcoholism to get out. One time I tried to commit suicide so many times it started to damage my health. And I had medications to pull me down, and I went to the AA meetings and listened to them success stories. I tried Alcoholics Anonymous in conjunction with fringe religions where you sit on back porches and mispronounce wrong words and discuss the transcendental rebirth of the spirit. And then the mother said that they go red. They're all square out there. They're Baptists. We know. And then the sun comes up and we crawl back in our caskets and they all get up and go around. I've tried Alcoholics Anonymous in conjunction with every therapy I've been able to find, and I have an inquisitive mind. And that's why it's kind of strange for me to say, isn't it funny today that I'm standing here to tell you that I've been sober just about 12 years now? And the only magic I have ever found in my life is Alcoholics Anonymous, unsupported by any adjunctive therapy, no matter its worth. I'm here today to tell you that a crazy, insane, lost, frightened animal, when driven far enough and given some involved guidance, not the guidance of here's your book, now do right, involved guidance has enabled me to live in the world. I hear miracles of things happening to you. That is not the miracle that impresses me. The miracle that happens to me is that I can walk out on Biscayne Boulevard and not be afraid this afternoon. And I don't have... And when I'm not afraid, I don't have to be hostile. And I don't have to hurt people. And I don't have to... Now here's the kind of the
small miracle. And we came down a couple of days earlier and went over to Billy D from Pittsburgh. He's a wealthy eccentric that has his summer home over in Naples. And I roomed with a priest. Now, when I was 3 years old, I know I heard you don't do that. Don't they'll try to get your heart, then they'll try to get the White House. Yeah. Some of you don't know that God slowly circles the Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And he gives it to sinners. And he gives it to Catholics. And that's okay with me, John. Here I am roaming with a priest. Now, the rest of the AAs in this community were out in the bay. We were out in the Everglades addressing a group of 20 apathetic prisoners in the Collier County Stockade, which is not air conditioned. And every once in a while, somebody come by to dust their eyeballs, you know. Now, why would anybody do that at a convention week? Why don't you have fun? Because to me, at least for me, these are the actions that are required for me. I don't impress them on anyone else. I am kind of a... People sometimes think they're hurting me a little bit when they say, you know, you're a terribly controversial figure. Because I'm one way. I've been to the White House, and I don't speak to AA, but I secretly think I do. Don't tell Rome. I am one way. They don't understand. When I get to be controversial, that's progress. There didn't used to be any controversy at all about me. You know, I was a dumb son of a bitch. Well, I'm not an AA, you know. I've had many wonderful things happen. But I'd like to tell you about it. When I was sober 5 years finally, my wife and four little daughters finally made one more trip out to California. We all lived happily ever after, I guess. And like the young lady, we had a son representing that reconciliation. It was our first sober reconciliation. I've had my job now, a hostile punk like me, for the last several years, I've been working as a public relations executive. I just go around making friends with people all day long. And I say, hi, Harry, how have you been? How's the wife and kid? And in another 11 years, I hope to be interested in your answers. What you would call a good man. Compared to almost anyone on this program, I am sure that I am, on an abstract scale, probably not among the weller. But I know this. I am the best Clancy emissary I have ever had. I am living year after year after year in that world, getting more comfortable. I am not as spiritual as I might be. I've come to believe in God, but not as effusively as some people talk about in the Bodian. But I've had a chance to trust many people who have been so spiritual that they couldn't get to meetings anymore because they were beneath their dignity. Something my sponsor in Los Angeles told me 11 years ago, I've never failed. I have never said no to an AA request in 11 years. It's easy to say yes, yes, I'll come to Miami and address them. It's something else when some old goof comes up and says, when you give me a ride home, I'm going the other direction, but I hear you got a car. I happen to be a circuit speaker. Screw off, Jack. You may think that, but what you say is, why, yes. And the nicest thing I know, at least for many people like me, your motives never have to be right. You can have the rottenest motive that ever did in the world. But if you do the things, you will feel better. And if you do them long enough, your motives will change, I believe. I, as I said, a nice job and a family. I don't have to sleep in an abandoned car. I'll sleep in my own car if I want to sleep in the car. Sometimes there are five of them kids and my granddaughter going, and then where's that old abandoned car? Just a couple of them. And the wind is shouting, come to now, now. But I tell you this. I had to find something in Alcoholics Anonymous that I would have sworn after 9 years around this organization was not here. And I tell you, today it is here. I had to find some way to replace what booze did for me. Because without that, I am unwinding, just as springs are breaking, wow, and I've got to come. What booze did for me, it made the world comfortable. What Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me is taken away one way to make the world comfortable and given me a continuing way to make the world comfortable. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is not that I'm sober. I was sober in the Texas Tuck House for a long time. I served in 32 jails after I came to AA. I've been sober a lot of places. It's not that I've got a coat that I stole off Joseph and his brethren. I'm in Central Square now in Fort Worth Central Park. The miracle of AA is if you feel alone and afraid and think you're the only one that knows that secret sense of inadequacy that you can't talk to anybody about, and you know you really don't fit in, and you know that no matter how much they like you, pretty soon they'll reject you, and they'll get tired of you, your clever little phrases that you memorize. If you ever get sick of being alone, like Walt said, the disease of loneliness, if you ever just want to cry, and you can't cry, if you want to kill yourself, if you want to run, if you want to do all these things, and you think that makes you unique, disabuse yourself of that idea. There are a lot of us here. And what I'm here to tell you is you don't have to feel that way for the rest of your life, for God's sakes. If you commit yourself, don't be a diddly. Stay away from the people who are trying to find out how little they have to do to stay sober, and get with the people who are trying to find out how they have to do to get comfortable. Get to those meetings. Like an old guy told me in Chicago once, I tell you, he's crazy. You go to a lot of meetings here, you try to work on steps, and some days you hang on. But if anybody in this hall today feels about anything like them, and you want my advice after 11 years of success of AA, and it is much success, but for me it's a magic success, I'll give you in one sentence. You go to a lot of meetings, you try to work those steps, and some days you just hang on. I spoke at a lot of conventions, maybe. I'm closing this sentence, sir. I have one sentence left on my action commas, isn't it? In the last few years, I've spoken at a lot of conventions, and I've been in Boston at one of the finest AA conventions in the world, and many other conventions, so this is really a big ego trip to go speak at an AA convention. Here's the big ego trip to be in front of people. I do that a lot in my job and everywhere else. I'll tell you the greatest thing that's ever happened to me in my life is me standing at this podium today, however. That is the best thing that has ever happened to me. Because it's as though somewhere in some abstraction, Alcoholics Anonymous, which has become my life, has reached out and said, even enough like you belongs here. We're glad to have you. Thank you.